Welcome to The Craft of Preaching, an online conference hosted by Luther Seminary, October 5th through 7th, 2020. This episode is Unpacking the Sermon with Jared Alcantara.
Good to be with everyone here at the conference. So thankful for this invitation, this kind and generous invitation, and for the hospitality that all of you have extended to me thus far. Thank you. It's good to be here. Well, what I'd like to do over the next couple of minutes as we unpack the sermon is I'd like to walk you through my process. And I feel like that would be hopefully helpful to you as those who preach on a regular basis, just to walk through how I moved from text to sermon, and then also to walk through some of the factors or thoughts that went into the preparation process. And so that's what we're going to do for the next couple of minutes. I'd also like to see what kinds of questions arise as you interact with me too. So that's something that you can do on the chat feature as you interact with Don Allitz. So here's what I'll do over these next couple of minutes. I'll walk you through the process that went into the preparation of that sermon. And I'll let you know, just to give you some conceptual categories for what went into it, I'll try to categorize those categories in a way that I hope will be helpful to you in your regular practice of preaching. So that's where we're headed. We'll talk through the 1 Peter chapter 3 text. I'll talk to you a little bit about what went into it. We'll talk about some conceptual categories that I think will be helpful not only for this text, but then also would be helpful for the regular practice of preaching. And Don makes a great observation to the attendees. If you have questions, you're welcome to put them into the chat, and we'll have a chance for Q&A at the end. Thanks so much. Well, let's spend a little time talking about this particular text, what went into it, and the exegetical process. That's where we'll start, and then I'll move into some conceptual categories that I hope will be helpful in thinking about this text and thinking about other texts as we prepare to preach, as we plan to preach. So when it comes into the exegetical process itself, because of my background, my fascination with languages, with biblical studies, I'm a bit of a language nerd and a bit of a commentaries nerd. That's really where I start. I try to start in the text itself. And sometimes if you're preaching more than one text in a lectionary context, you'll be looking at the interplay or the intertextual conversation that's taking place. In this case, I was trying to do a deep dive into one particular text. So I tried to get into the languages the best that I could, especially as someone who loves languages. If you don't have a Greek or Hebrew background, that doesn't disqualify you from being able to do word studies or interact with what the commentators have said from the original languages. So I don't want to lift that up as something that there's like some sort of secret access that I can get through study of the original languages. I just love trying to do a deep dive, trying to get closer to the text in any way that I can. So usually what I do is I try to look at the text in the original language, in this case, Greek. Try to look at the repetition of key words, key phrases. Try to do word studies the best that I can. And usually what I try to do is I try to look at the occurrence of words or key phrases in the book itself. So in this case, 1 Peter. And then I would try to work my way out. So I would look at other epistles to which Peter is attributed as author, look at other key statements in which Peter speaks, and try to work my way out in concentric circles. And so I don't want to just make random connections with other word occurrences throughout the Bible or throughout the New Testament. I want to try to work my way out, like, do we see key words, key phrases in this particular text? And then do we see it in chapter 3? Do we see it in the book of 1 Peter? And working my way out that way. So I'm also particularly interested in this text because it has been used in very negative and harmful ways. And so that question was on my mind from the very beginning. How has this text been used in the history of interpretation? And what can we learn from that, good and bad? There are redemptive ways that this text has been used, and there are very harmful and counterproductive and even destructive ways that this text has been used. And so that question was on my mind from the very beginning. And I wanted to take advantage of the opportunities that I had to ask people in my circles of influence, not only what they thought about this text, but where could they direct me so that I might have some fresh readings of this text? Because I didn't want to just have traditional readings of the text. I wanted to see if there were some fresh readings of the text that would be especially helpful for me to come into contact with. And so I contacted people and asked them what their take was on it. I, in my case, interacted with some New Testament scholars, because there's some on my faculty and there's some at my former school, and just asked them what they thought. One particular book-length treatment of the book of 1 Peter is a book called Strangers to Family by Shively Smith. A quote from that book came up in the sermon itself. That book, along with other fresh readings of the book of 1 Peter, in which the language of being sojourners and strangers is not so much language of escapism or of heavenly by and by language, but instead is a language of active resistance and survival strategies in the midst of persecution and oppressive structures. That for me was particularly powerful. And to read Dr. Shively Smith's book, Strangers to Family, was particularly powerful as well, because she's trying to look at what this text has been used to communicate, especially in North America and especially toward marginalized communities, in particular Black communities historically, and then try to look back and say, well, how has this text been misused, misappropriated? How has it been disentangled, or I should say jettisoned, from its original hearers and from its original intent? So that was a question that was on my mind from the very beginning that I really wanted to explore further. And getting into her work, getting into the work of other key New Testament commentators, in particular commentators on 1 Peter, was really something that I wanted to do from the very beginning. So I wanted to challenge my own presuppositions because there's what I thought that I might be seeing, but I wanted to lean on the perspectives of people who spent their whole dissertation studying this, or people who spent a whole career in this text. So relying on the perspectives of a multiplicity of voices, people who have different takes on this text, was especially important to me. And then just trying to challenge my own pre-understandings. And so I enter the text, there's my initial hunches, there's my thoughts that come to me as I'm trying to inhabit the world of the text, but I need to check those initial thoughts, those initial pre-understandings, those initial presuppositions through my interaction with people who know the language better than I do, who know the ancient world better than I do, who know the scholarship better than I do. And so a good dose of epistemic humility is always important in our interactions with the text of Scripture, to recognize, to understand what we can, but then also to interact with those who have spent a lifetime working on these texts. That stated, when I first started out in my preaching, I sounded too much like the commentators. And what I came to realize, and this is a quote from someone on my faculty, Dr. Gregory, Joel Gregory, he likes to say that commentaries are guides, but not gods. They're guides, but not gods. And so that's something that has come up over and over again in my preaching, to take the best of what I can from the commentaries, especially since those commentaries will shed light on my pre-understandings of the text and may challenge my initial presuppositions, but not to let them drive the bus, if you will. I can benefit from it, but what I want to do is I also want to come down with my own take, especially in spaces where commentators might disagree. So, for example, Jesus going and preaching to the spirits in prison, I did a little ironic twist in the sermon itself where I said, not even the commentaries can help us with this particular text. In fact, sometimes the commentaries can be counterproductive on this particular text. What you find in some of the commentaries is you find pages and pages and pages of Jesus preaching to the spirits in prison and what the commentator thinks, but you don't actually get the whole pericope, the whole text. And so you might have 30 pages on the debate over Jesus proclaiming to the spirits in prison and what that might mean. And then you have 10 pages devoted to, you know, the other 14 verses. So sometimes there can be a skewing of interest, especially as the commentators interact with the current scholarship and the current debates. So I want to interact with them. I want to learn from them. I want to try to take the best of what I can from them. But it's also important for my voice to come out. So in other words, I don't want to be a carbon copy of this commentator or what that commentator has to say. I want to learn from them. I want to grow from them. I might even quote from them, but it's not going to drive the boat for me or drive the bus for me. So that's a little bit of a glimpse into my exegetical process, trying to interact with the languages, trying to study up on the commentaries, trying to at least discern the best that I can what I believe might be the main thrust of this text, trying to think through as I move from text to sermon how I might try to talk about 15 verses or so in 20 minutes. Even just the reading of the text is going to be over 3 minutes long. And so now as I'm thinking about moving from text to sermon, I know that I can't talk about everything. So I have to only talk about some things. And if so, what are those things going to be? James Earl Massey, who's now deceased, great preacher, great homiletician, prolific writer, gifted in so many different ways. He used to say that good preaching is not just about what we say, it's about what we know and don't say. So you do a deep dive into the study, you learn the best that you can, but you also have to make some editorial choices. And that's what I had to do in a sermon with so many verses, but with limited time. Now, that's an especially important task for preachers. What I'll say to students in preaching class, I usually bring up two different ideas with them. One is the statement in Hollywood, which goes like this: there are Oscar-winning performances that have been left on the cutting room floor. There are Oscar-winning performances that have been left on the cutting room floor. And so even though the performance was good, even though the actor did right by the script, the editor has to come in and say, this doesn't fit the larger story that we're trying to tell. And so it has to go, it has to be cut. The second quote that I usually use, it's attributed to Stephen King, but it precedes him, murder your darlings, murder your darlings. And what does he mean by that? If he could have it his way, he would write 1,000-page horror novels. But he knows that he can't, he knows that he shouldn't. And so these are the ideas that you think should be in there, but you know can't be in there because you have to make some editorial choices. You have to, in a sense, murder your darlings. You know, the things that you wish you could put in there, but that you know that you can't put in there because you have some limited time and space. You can't say everything. When everything is important, nothing is. So we have to make some choices about what's most important to say, not only what we know and say, but what we know and don't say. So that guided my process as well as I was making the move from text to sermon, as I was thinking about how I could try to communicate such a lengthy text in a limited amount of time. So that was also a part of my process. And now let me give you some conceptual categories. And these conceptual categories appear in my latest book, The Practices of Christian Preaching, which came out in 2019. The Spanish version comes out later this year. But I talk about five C's with a sixth C being at the center of it. And the reason why I teach with these categories in mind is in a way it gives some conceptual categories for preachers to think about as they move from text to sermon with any particular text. So let me start with the first C, and the first C is clarity. So clarity. I knew that there were exegetical hurdles in the text. I knew that the text has been used to harm. I knew that one of the exegetical hurdles was this idea of Jesus proclaiming to the spirits in prison. I knew that it was a long pericope. I had to think through how might I try to be concise in my exegesis, clear in my structure, how might I use accessible language, and how might I find a way to practice brevity. even in the face of an audaciously long text with a lot of challenging marks in it. So I tried to go with a clear structure where I talked about maybe this text is about love toward one another, maybe it's about love toward outsider, maybe it's about following in the way of Christ and his suffering, or maybe it's about this one most important thing. So I tried to give some structure to the sermon in a way that would make sense. I repeated my key moves in the sermon. Some preachers like to use the analogy of the bones and the flesh. And so every sermon should have bones, a clear structure, and it should have flesh, some clear substance. And if you have clear substance without clear structure, then it's hard to discern what the flesh looks like and why it's important for us to understand it better. But if you have no structure, then that's also a problem too. Or you can be overstructured. That's what I meant to say. So overstructuring sounds like Roman numeral 2, letter A, subpoint 1, letter B. So there's such a thing as having too much bones and not enough flesh too, where the people get lost. What are you on, point 7? Are you on point 5? Are you on point 4? You can overstructure a sermon too. So I tried to make my structure simple. I tried to make my main idea concise, accessible, and memorable. So remember resurrection. And I tried to move there inductively. I tried to repeat and restate that idea. So vindication comes tomorrow for those enduring hardship today. Remember resurrection is something that I repeated over and over again. And then I found different ways to point to hope. So repetition and restatement become another way that we can make something ambiguous clearer than we would otherwise. So that's the first C, is clarity. And within that category of clarity, you know, we think about, is our exegesis concise? Is our main idea clear? Are we using accessible language? Are we committing to brevity as an editor as well? Second C is contextualization. This is a sermon to Christian leaders. This is a sermon that's taking place in a North American context. This is a sermon that's taking place during a pandemic, and in particular during a pandemic in which some minoritized communities, in particular the Black community, has described it as a double pandemic. And so I brought that up in the sermon, that some communities think they're only experiencing one pandemic, when actually there are communities that feel like they're experiencing two. So this is a sermon that's happening in a particular time and place, in a particular historical moment. For those of you who are recording sermons regularly a couple of days ahead of time, I recorded this sermon before the debate and before the president came down with coronavirus. And so perhaps you can relate to that, where you record a sermon and then something major happens in our news cycle, where you just know that if you could record it live, you would probably bring up some things that you wouldn't, or that you didn't bring up in the recorded version. That happened to me back in May when I prepared a series of sermons for a conference that I was scheduled to be at in June that was canceled. And a week or two after I recorded those sermons, George Floyd was killed. So we had to find a way in the conference to talk about some of the things that were most pressing at that particular moment that I didn't include in the sermon. And so that's something to bear in mind too, the live portions of your service. If you record your sermon ahead of time, how might you contextualize even more, even better, through the elements of the worship service that are live rather than recorded? Back to this idea of contextualization. I also think about contextualization across the communion of saints, across time and tradition. So yes, we're called to preach timely sermons, but we're also called to preach sermons that at least have a pointer to global realities too. So I thought about how this text would be heard in the first century, how it might have been heard across the centuries. I thought about how different communities throughout the world have understood Christian witness, either positively or negatively. And so contextualization, Leslie Newbegin, I mentioned him at the end of the sermon. Leslie Newbegin describes over-contextualization and under-contextualization as the Scylla and the Charybdis of Christian mission. In other words, if you under-contextualize, you can lose the people to whom the gospel is preached. If you over-contextualize, you can give away the farm, as it were, and not focus on a vibrant, prophetic, healthy gospel witness. So I don't want to try to communicate that I was trying to figure out every single way that I could make this sermon touch down in this particular time and place, because when you over-contextualize, you can fail to be prophetic. It can become a slippery slope, if you will, in which you don't interact with people or communities outside your own community. And you might find a way not to say anything that would challenge or call people forward or call people out of false alliances and false allegiances. So that's contextualization. That's the second one. Third one is concreteness. So we have clarity, contextualization, concreteness. That has to do with illustration and application. So illustrations started with a story about my tía in Honduras and going to see her. Also told stories about Nietzsche's Thus Spoke Zarathustra. Shared a story about a friend of mine working as a social worker in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Shared a story about Gandhi, first in South Africa and then in India. Told a story about Bonhoeffer. And sometimes these were very short stories with a quotation. I had some intentionality about telling stories from different parts of the world, and also stories in which those who don't claim to be Christ followers are calling Christ followers to account, challenging them, pushing back. I shared stories from my own life. I shared stories that included the communion of saints, if you will, people from different time periods, people from different places as well. That was important to me. But one way to think about concreteness, at least when it comes to illustration, an illustration is basically anything that sheds light upon something that's abstract. So sometimes we think about the one memorable story that we tell in an introduction or in a conclusion, when in fact, there's a multiplicity of opportunities before us to shed light on something that's abstract. So love each other better than we do now, that's abstract. Well, what does that look like? What does humility look like? Well, it might look like we're willing to say sorry. It might look like we don't have to have the last word. It might look like X or Y or Z. What does it look like that only a suffering God will help? Will preach. Well, that is good news. That's a good word for someone who's going through another round of chemotherapy. That's good news. That's a good word for someone whose spouse walked out on the family. That's good news. That's a good word for someone who's afraid to get COVID. So all that is to say, an illustration is anything that sheds light upon something that's abstract. So it could be a story, it could be a quote, it could be a statistic, it could be an analogy, it could be a metaphor. There's lots of different ways that we can shed light on that, which is abstract. Application. What does that look like? That's a question that I find myself asking all the time. And sometimes when we struggle in the area of application, a good place to start, it's not the place to start and end, but a good place to start is with me, right? What does it look like for me to remember resurrection? I know that after my parents got COVID, I mentioned that COVID impacted my life personally. My parents got COVID this summer. They both spent time in the hospital. What does it look like for me to remember resurrection? I'm very nervous whenever I'm in public now. Remembering resurrection means, of course, I practice all the CDC guidelines. I do all the things that I'm supposed to do, but I also choose not to live in fear. I choose to go out to the places that I need to go to while also practicing the safeguards that I need to practice. But I choose to remember hope, even in the midst of this strange time in our world. So what does that look like? So you could start with you. You don't end with you. But you could start with you if you're struggling to think through application. And of course, what does that look like for my congregation? What does that look like for my people to remember resurrection? Are there specific examples that I can think of people who did this, people who are doing this? What would it look like for me to call people to do this? What would it look like for me to imagine a church that chooses to do this in its community? What would it look like for me to imagine a church that does this right now in such a divided time in our nation? So that's concreteness, illustration, and application. S.I. Hayakawa says, we must climb down the ladder of abstraction. He's not saying you can't be abstract. He's saying we must climb down that ladder so that we have both abstraction and concreteness in our sermons. And in his case, he would say speeches, since he's a language theorist. But in our case, in our sermons. So that's the third one. So we have clarity, contextualization, concreteness, creativity. Creativity has to do with our language, so our poetics, and it has to do with our storytelling. Now, creativity is about a lot more than that, but I try to at least give those categories within the category of creativity just as a way that might be helpful conceptually. So poetics, our language. Gardner Taylor used to say that we operate in two currencies, the currency of our integrity and the currency of language. And if you debase either currency, if you start in particular the currency of language, in this particular address he was talking about that, if you start using words wrongly, then you've neglected the power of that currency to communicate truth and to communicate that which would mislead or lead people astray. Words are cheap. Well, that depends on whether or not we cheapen them, Taylor used to say. Storytelling. Storytelling has to do with trying to think well about what details matter most in the stories we tell from Scripture and in the stories we tell about our lives, and what details are peripheral. What details are crucial? What details are peripheral? In a preaching class, this might sound like the preacher who tells a 5-minute story that ends up taking up a significant percentage of the sermon. The story will be better in 2 minutes than it would have been in 5 minutes, but that's going to require from the preacher a willingness to self-edit and to say there are stories or there are aspects to this story that matter and aspects that don't. So poetics, storytelling. So if it happened to you, let's say you preach with notes rather than preaching without notes, if it happened to you, it's very difficult for listeners to engage with you if you read a story that happened to you. You know that it happened to you. So I invite you to try to take the notes off the page and tell the story in a way you would if you were sitting at a table with people over dinner. I invite you in your language. Yes, we can practice simple, clear speech, but we can also think through the poetic side of preaching sermons as well. Is there a way to say it differently? Is there a way to make our words sing? Is there a way to say it in such a way that people will be likely to remember it? Why do I say that? Because by Tuesday, I've forgotten what the main idea of my sermon is. So if I've forgotten it and I preached, then how much more likely is it that the people to whom I preached will have forgotten it by Tuesday? So thinking about sticky statements, memorable statements that we might craft as communicators. We're coming down the home stretch here, so clarity, contextualization, concreteness, creativity, conviction. I'll just say a brief word about conviction. What do I believe about this text? What is my responsibility as a preacher of the gospel? Do I feel this text? I think about that text in Jeremiah 20 as if it's a fire shut up in my bones. I'm weary of holding it in. And it's not just the text, but it's the sermon that has come about from this text. Is there a sense of urgency? I remember at one particular school when I was sitting with a preaching professor. Every once in a while, the preaching professor would ask the preacher after the preacher preached, so did you believe it? Did you believe it? So sometimes we feel like we're up there because we have to say something. It's our responsibility. It's what we're called to do. It's part of the office of pastor. But I would invite us to think through, are we up there because we have to say something, or are we up there because we have something to say? So that's part of the move from text to sermon as well, too, this convictional piece. Conviction is one of those great indispensable qualities that's very difficult to teach in a preaching class. Do you believe it? Do you have something to say? Are you Are you passionate about it? Is it something that you're weary of holding in? So that's conviction. And then at the center of that wheel, so just kind of imagine this wheel, at the center of that wheel is preaching Christian sermons. So we have clarity, we have contextualization, concreteness, creativity, conviction. And then at the center is this a Christian sermon? So we ask those big questions. Does my sermon have good news? Tom Long likes to say that no news is bad news in a Christian sermon. So are we there to explain something, or are we there to proclaim something? Now, you need explanation to get to proclamation, but so often we stop at explanation. Not in every case, in every situation, in every church context. Just want to push us to think through this. If we don't have an accent on proclamation, is there something that we need to proclaim? Is there news from this text, or if you're preaching in a lectionary setting, from these texts as they interact with one another, that we could communicate? We are pointers to the hope of the gospel, bearers, stewards of the gospel. So what hope do you want to communicate? People get beat up and worn down throughout the week. What would it look like? What would it sound like to be a pointer to hope, a bringer of hope, a steward of hope in a way that will help people to stand a little straighter and walk with a little more confidence and hold on to something throughout the week that'll get them through to the next week? So that's some conceptual categories. I think we're at time, so I'm going to turn it back to Don for a Q&A. And Don, I'll pass it over to you, and we'll see if there are any questions that are coming from the chat.
There are. They've been very busily putting questions in there and voting them up. And we have a group of people that wants to know, is this really how you prepare all of your sermons? Because it seems like in a typical pastor week, there isn't enough time. And if there is not enough time, what do you focus on?
That's a great question. Now that I'm a professor, I am preaching as an itinerant, which means that I'm still preaching very actively, but it's not the same as preaching, you know, 40 plus times a year. So I was a teaching pastor when I was a PhD student at the same time and was an associate pastor through the years. So there was a time when I was preaching, 40 to 50 times a year on, 40 to 50 Sundays a year. I'm still preaching very actively in churches. During COVID, it's a little different. But sometimes I'm prepping more than one sermon in a given week if I'm preaching it like at Baylor or at some other university chapel, or I might be at a conference, for example. I might be prepping sermons at the same time, and then I'm also trying to juggle all of my other responsibilities. And so I'm glad that that question was raised. I know that it's a challenge that I have faced and that I continue to face in trying to almost spin too many plates and not have enough time. And it feels like some plates have to fall in order for us to be able to do what we can do. Just a word about that. One would be a word of encouragement. So I have three kids. I can think of times when my kids were throwing up on a Saturday night and I still needed to preach on Sunday morning. Or I can think of times where we've also been foster care parents. I can think of times when our foster kids were going through a real challenging week, a challenging time, I still needed to get up on Sunday morning. I still had a sermon to get up with all of things going crazy. I can think of times when things were going crazy at church, when things were going crazy at home. It's a real perfect storm when both are happening with your family or with what's going on at church. Some people use the metaphor or the analogy of cooking. Not every meal is going to be perfect, but what really matters, an act of love for anyone who cooks in their home, is to serve meals faithfully over time. So it's not like a one shot, this meal better be perfect. Sometimes we have limited time, we have limited ingredients, we have limited capacity, we have limited sleep. We have lots of limitations. But what matters most, especially in a regular preaching ministry and pastoral ministry, is to use what the ingredients we have and the time that we have in a way that's faithful. So it's important for us to get out of categories of 6S and to move into the categories that Jesus uses, faithfulness and fruitfulness. So let's be faithful with the time that we have, with the resources that we have, with the ingredients that we have, with the time that we have, and trust God that faithfulness over time is what will minister to people and what will be a faithful offering before God. The challenge that I would say is that most researchers on creativity say that usually at least a 10-day process can be especially helpful for releasing those juices of creativity. So a slow cooker meal is always better than a microwave meal. So even if you spend 30 minutes on a sermon that you know will be the Sunday after this one, just the activation, even at the unconscious level, of interacting with that text or texts more than a couple days ahead of time can be especially helpful when it comes time to really try to get that sermon together and to get it ready. So I encourage people to try to move up their process, even with limited time, so that they can activate their creativity.
In keeping with that cooking analogy then, so when you have a short amount of time, what questions are you sure to ask? What ingredients do you keep in your cupboard for those moments when you know you're short of time? Where do you go first as far as questions of what you ask the text?
Yeah, a few things come to mind. One is that sometimes we confine the thinking process to the seats that we sit in with the Bible open or our commentaries open. But some of our best ideas, I'm trying to remember the name of the person who said this, but some of our best ideas come to us, what is it? Is the bus, the bath, and you know, there's another B, I can't think of the other B. And we find ourselves like, oh, if I only had a notebook, if I only had a piece of paper, and then the thought's gone. So I really encourage people with limited time to see time outside of the official preparation process as time that can be redeemed. And this is Anna Carter Florence's work too, Preaching as Testimony. You can walk the text, you can jog the text, you can, she says, you can soccer mom the text. There's all kinds of ways that you can let this text communicate to you and preach to you. What sorts of ingredients? There have been times where I can't do a deep dive into the language, or I can't do a deep dive into the commentaries. I can't do a deep dive in the way that I want to. So when I'm preaching to people I know, in which case when I was preaching regularly to people that I know and knew at my particular church, I'm always asking the question, you know, what does good news sound like to this community in this particular time and place? How do I communicate in a language that's accessible to these people in this particular time and place? And at a church that has multiple services, I might be thinking contextually about one service where the median age is much older than another service. So I might be thinking about that contextual element as well. So, I try to be as faithful as I can with the time that I have. And try to see my preparation process as not just something that's officially taking place when I'm sitting down and trying to type a sermon. I try to, because I wanted to see the preparation of the sermon as a spiritual practice as well, even if it's not perfectly written up, even if my time is limited, if I can somehow get it off the page and in here, then that's going to be more helpful to me, since I'm allowing God to preach to me first, and then more helpful to them, since it'll be more internalized, more personal, and more pastoral. So I can be set free to be pastoral if I'm not so bound to the page. I can be set free to pastor people while I preach and provide care while I preach, even on limited time, if somehow I can get it off the page and in here, whatever that might look like for you, that's what I would encourage you to do.
Great, thanks. We have time for one more, and that is from several of our attendees. It says, one of the things I struggle with is finding fresh and accessible scholarly interpretations of the texts. I serve alone in a congregation. I'm not a great academic, and searching online is overwhelming. Do you have any advice on where to start searching for help on texts?
That's a great question. I know that there are various websites that are available that are vetted and that have more of the scholarly contributions to them, but they're designed for working preachers. So that could be something perhaps that the Craft of Preaching conference would provide participants at some point, either during the conference or after the conference, a particular sites that would lead you, almost like a search engine might lead you, but vetted to particular commentaries and particular articles or essays on a passage of scripture. I remember, I've served in different places in the country. I'm from New Jersey, so I've served churches there. I went to seminary in Massachusetts, spent time in Illinois, served a church in Oregon on the West Coast. Now I'm in Texas. We can't figure out where to land. But I remember even just in one particular place feeling like I wish that I lived near a seminary because then I could try to check books out of the library or try to interact with some of the latest stuff. I have an embarrassment of riches in that I can walk down the hall and talk to a New Testament scholar if I want to. Most people don't have that. But I would say that there are vetted websites that are available, and perhaps the Craft of Preaching could assist in which sites would be most helpful to you. I think with serving in a church as a lone pastor, of course, can be very lonely, and it could be very challenging to know where to start. I do know that seminaries and divinity schools try to provide commentary lists. So that's something that you could check out. You could try to reach out to me over email, and I could let you know where some of those lists are. So those are vetted commentaries that biblical studies people have vetted. I also know that I benefit greatly from hearing what other people have preached on these texts. So whether it's sermons that we read, like how people handle the texts matters to me as well. Because like I said, commentaries are guides, but they're not gods. And the commentators might have a disproportionate amount of emphasis or interest in things that might not be most important to talk about in a sermon. So I listen to lots of sermons, try to watch sermons, try to read sermons, and look at how others have looked at this text, not just in the 20th or 21st century, since audio or video became available, but even historically, how have church fathers talked about this text? Even if it's just 15 minutes, there might be a way for me to think about that. How has this text been used and misused? How has it been redemptively used? So those sorts of things, I think, are available to us. They're especially challenging to find, but I would just offer a word of hope that there is a way to find really well-curated resources.